Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business, brought to you this week by Checkpoint Software Technologies. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is a great one, for a bunch of reasons really. For starters, our regular news guest Munir Kataria, who is of course the editor at ZDNet Australia, he's back after a 6-week absence. We'll also be chatting to one of our semi-regular guests, Kimberly Zenz, who's a senior threat analyst with iDefence, which is of course now a unit of VeriSign. Kimberly knows the underground like the back of her hand, and she'll be along shortly to have a chat about the shutdown of McColo. Similar to the RBN, McColo was a bulletproof hosting company based in California, and they are no more. It was shut down last week, resulting in a global drop in spam levels of between 65 and 75%. It's a stunning result, and we'll have a chat to Kimberly about what it might mean for the future. Are the bad guys now on the back foot? That's coming up soon. We'll also be checking in with Steve McDonald, Checkpoint's Engineering Services Manager. Steve says a lot of companies out there in enterprise land have been a little bit slack when it comes to capacity planning. Yes, I know it's not exactly a sexy topic, but Steve says this is a real problem out there, and it's not limited to smaller organisations. But first up, he's been in India for 6 weeks, but he's back. He slices, he dices, he analyses news headlines. Please welcome back to Risky Business, ZDNet Australia's editor, their main man, Munir Kataria.
Why, thank you. It's been very, very strange being completely offline for a month and a half. I know, yeah. I go away, what happens? The economy collapses, they have a new president, it's all gone mad.
Yes, it has. But there's been a few things happen while you've been away, let us just say. But good to have you back on the show, and I've got to say, I every time I'd be at an event or whatnot, I'd have people asking me, when's Munir coming back on the show? So there
Yay,
you go.
Yay, fame at last.
You were missed. You were definitely missed, my friend.
Well, it's great to be back.
Excellent. Well, let's get on with a look at the last week's news headlines. And okay. A ISP and an ad company, like an online advertising company, they're being sued over their advertising system. This is a very interesting story.
It is, actually. I mean, how do you say this? Nebuad?
Nebuad.
Yeah. It's, apparently they violated hacking and wiretapping laws because they were monitoring, what does it say? Nebuad paid ISPs to let it install internet monitoring machines inside their network. So basically they looked and see, they monitored where the users were surfing and gave them targeted ads, which is legal.
Yeah, well, I don't know that it is legal. I think that's why this lawsuit's come up. This story was run on the Wired 27B/6 blog. And it just seems that what they were doing is installing some devices that actually modified people's traffic on the fly and like really looked at what they were doing online so that they could give them targeted ads when they visited sites where Nebuad actually sold those ads. Excuse me. So, yeah, a very interesting story there, and it'll be interesting to see what the outcome of that lawsuit is. I suppose this is...
It sounds like great technology, though. If it was implemented properly and legally, it sounds like the future, really.
We're going to have to watch and see what happens with this lawsuit, because it could have some pretty wide-ranging implications for the online advertising industry, which, of course, Munir, you and I kind of depend on.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you one thing, this does show that it's only the government that can illegally wiretap and get away with it.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, it's good to have you back. Now, this next story we're going to be taking up a little bit later in the show with our guest Kimberly Zenz. But
We like her.
We do. We do like Kimberly, so she'll be along in a little bit. McColo, I guess that's like McDonald's, but for colo services. The takedown of McColo has resulted in a 75% drop in spam levels. This is just unbelievable.
It is. I mean, how can this be so? And why has it taken so long for them to figure out that there's this one service, basically, which is providing all of this spam? It just seems crazy.
Well, I think that's what is fascinating about this story, is I don't think anyone realized you could actually make such a significant dent on spam volumes with such a precision surgical strike. Now, this company, McColo, which is a hosting provider based in San Jose in California, they've basically been de-peered after a lot of heat came on them from Brian Krebs, who was writing for the Washington Post. And, yeah, unbelievably, Message Labs, McAfee, Symantec, and Arbor Networks all detected drops in spam volumes.
So yeah, and they're saying between 60 and 75%, which is just crazy figures there.
Yeah, and I've spoken to people out there in the field, and they say that is actually legit, that figure. So, and it's rare to see all of the vendors actually agreeing on a trend, because normally, you know, you'll get one report which says spam's up, and
yeah.
the same day you'll get a report from a competing vendor which says it's down. So,
yeah, but I don't think it's going to have much effect. Well, according to this Message Labs guy, Matt Sargent, he says he doesn't believe it'll have a lasting effect on spam volumes. People responsible for this are making a lot of money. They're now going to work to get back to a position where they're making a lot of money again.
Yeah, yeah, they'll just sort of open up elsewhere, I guess. But, you know, the thing is, if they're going to open up in some really shitty backwards jurisdiction, I doubt they're going to have the connectivity that'd support their activities. So
Yeah. I mean, that would be a big reason for putting it in California, really. Yeah.
Mm-mm. So let's just really hope that this gives some renewed impetus behind the anti-spam movement and gets governments off their gigantic butt cheeks. What do you reckon?
Well, it's things like this that really make a difference, at least temporarily.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a temporary reprieve anyway. So yeah. My spam volume's gone from, you know, 600 a day to 200 a day. Yay.
Yeah.
Now, also from Security Focus, that last story was from Sec Focus. We covered this last week that a drug benefits provider, Express Scripts, they do like online prescriptions and whatnot. They'd been breached, and some people had tried to blackmail them. They said, you know, give us money or we will drop all of your customer data online. Now Express Scripts has turned around and said, hey, we've got a better idea. Well, first of all, they came clean with their customers and said, we have been breached and we're being blackmailed. And now they're releasing a $1 million bounty if people can provide information that leads to the capture and prosecution of the blackmailers.
Hey, it's good policy, I reckon.
Well, I think that's better than paying off the guys who pinched the data.
But, definitely, yeah.
But it's interesting, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, it says here that they've received a letter containing information from 75 of their customers just to prove that, you know, these attackers have all the information. It includes date of birth, social security numbers, even prescription information. So it's pretty serious info they've got. They seem to have everything. I'm wondering, okay, they were attacked, they were hacked. How well prepared were they? You know, I mean, was this data properly secured or were they just lapsed and, you know, they're paying the price for that now? I'm not quite sure to the background of this.
Well, that's interesting, actually. That's exactly what Adam Boileau, who was filling in for you last week, said. He said, look, you know, a better policy is not to get owned in the first place. But I think it is really interesting to see a company putting a massive financial incentive out there to try to get these guys caught and prosecuted, and we'll have to see if it works or if there's honour among thieves.
Or, of course, there could be some great scam where they actually go and dob someone else in and claim the money.
Yeah, they could frame them. They could hack into someone's system, leave the evidence, yeah.
Oh, we're not here to give them ideas.
No. All right, now, in this next piece, which comes from Maximum PC, very interesting story here. Google were running an AdWords campaign for a known malware provider. This is one of those malware groups that sells, you know, fake antivirus software and whatnot. And, it looks like they were happily taking their money for clicks through to their site. So,
That's right. The
bad guys are using Google AdWords to advertise.
Apparently, the guys from the magazine there, they typed in antivirus XP 2008, and that led to a URL, an advert, which was antivirus World 2009, which they recommend you don't go to because it's full of malware. Apparently, if you do a search on Google, it doesn't come up, but there was an advert
there.
It
won't come up in the organic listing. So they've been delisted for being dodgy, but there was a bit of a loophole, I guess, where they could actually start paying for the ads and it would pop up in the sponsored links. So
I had a look right now. I just did a little search and I can't find it, so I don't know. I mean, Google may have removed the advert as well, maybe due to the story. I don't know why.
I imagine this was an oversight, but it is interesting to see that they don't apply the same level of scrutiny to listings as they do to organic search results.
Well, there's a surprise. What did they get their cash from? Man, I think we're going to see a lot of this. You know, with this financial crisis economy being up the creek, it's we're going to get a lot more, I reckon.
You reckon we're going to see more scams and dodginess?
Well, there's got to be, really. I mean, you know, people are going to get desperate and I really think we're going to see an escalation.
I'm waiting for the new 419 scams, you know, which is like, yes, I am in the United States and I was an executive at, Merrill Lynch or whatever, you know, one of the big investment banks. And
That's right. I've just received my bailout check and I have $1 billion to give to somebody.
I need to get my golden parachute out of the country before Barack Obama steals it.
Oh, God, more ideas. I tell you, man, you're going to have more criminal subscribers, I'm sure.
Excellent. Go for those download numbers. Increase my reach into all sorts of new markets. That's great. Now, this is really interesting. Microsoft has finally got off its ass and patched the SMB relay flaw, which has been around and known about for about 7 years, and they finally actually patched it. This is
since
a fascinating
the .com bust. Really?
It's been around since the .com bust. Yeah.
This is really strange. The flaw could enable an SMB relay attack, which could allow an attacker to install programs, view, change, or delete data, or create new accounts with full user rights.
That's bad.
It's been around since 2001. Apparently, the Microsoft guy here, Christopher Budd, who's apparently the Microsoft Security Response Center chap, said that they didn't fix it because it would negatively impact network-based applications.
Yeah, well, it was going to break stuff. Yep. What's really interesting is since they have fixed it, our buddy HD Moore has got onto the Metasploit blog and said, well, you only kind of half fixed it. So it looks like it's, you know, it's still actually a problem. So this is one of those really nasty bugs that I think, you know, generally speaking, if Microsoft can patch something, they will. I think this is a real headache for those guys.
Yeah, they're going to have to change everything. I find it really interesting here that it says here that, to be clear, the impact would have been to render many or nearly all customers' network-based applications inoperable.
That's bad.
That's very, very bad. But isn't that what Windows Vista did?
Yeah, zing. Very funny, Manir.
All right, you can edit that one out.
But yeah, look, what HD Moore said about this is the MS08068 patch addresses this attack only in the case where the attacker connects back to the victim. The patch does not address the case where the attacker relays the connection to a third-party host that the victim has access to. So it is still a problem. I mean, it's good that they've made a step in the right direction, but I remember about 2 years ago, our mutual friend Adam Poynton saying to me, you know, I think HD Moore had done some work, incorporated some of this stuff into Metasploit, and he was saying, you know, this SMB relay stuff is really serious, and I don't think people really understand that. I think he might have even been at Vegas or something at DEF CON or whatever, and he'd just seen one of the talks and gone, I don't think people really got how bad that SMB relay stuff is. So looks like they get it now anyway.
Well, a little bit, yeah. And so it's still open there, but you just have to be careful.
Now, next up, we have a very interesting story from the Register, which says that phishing gangs don't actually make that much money. They're kind of, you know, just struggling to eke out a living. And the reason people jump into it and you see so many phishing messages is not because there is a lot of money in it, but because there's a perception that there's a lot of money in it. And crooks think they can go in and make an easy score.
Well, I think, you know, by the time the bandwagon's rolling, it's too late to get on, isn't it? I mean, all the guys that phishing, but there's so much awareness out there right now. You know, people are expecting phishing attacks. They're looking out for it. So I'm sure that the rate of people getting caught has gone down.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I spoke to a guy on a security team for a large bank in New Zealand, and they said that their entire phishing-related losses for all of 2007 was $200,000.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I think there is a little bit of overhype. I mean, they say here, and this is interesting, though, because I got I was interviewing a guy from Westpac, an Australian bank, several years ago, who said that the rate of account compromise was 0.4%. And, of course, they didn't release that stuff publicly, so he kind of screwed up by telling me that in the interview. But now these guys have done this research, say that 0.37% of web users hand over their identity credentials in response to phishing. And that is exactly the same rate as years ago.
That's pretty cool. And so it seems, I mean, according to those figures, it hasn't changed at all. And it says less than half of those people who actually hand over their details suffer any sort of financial fraud.
Well, that's the interesting part, isn't it? Because the banks have got good at blocking and detecting fraud.
And of course, the other lot have no cash.
Yes. That is true. But, it's just an interesting story here that says that phishing, you know, they don't actually make oodles and oodles of cash. They say that there's probably a group of people who control most of the successful stuff. You know, they know how to avoid the fraud, anti-fraud measures and things like that. But generally speaking, most of the little guys who get into making phishing, I mean, they'd probably make more money getting a job.
Yeah, there's a great quote here. It says the average fisher makes about as much as if he did something legal with his time.
Yeah, there you go. So go flip burgers and just save yourself the threat of having to go to prison all the bloody time, I say. And Manir, that's it for this week's news. Mate, fantastic to have you back. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks. Hopefully I'll be a bit less foggy next week.
Okay, well, until next week, mate, we'll chat then.
All right, cheers.
ZDNet Australia's editor, Mania Katadia there. And I'd just like to say thank you again to Adam Boileau from New Zealand, who was filling in for Mania while he was away. That was very kind of you, Adam, and most appreciated. Now, before we get to today's feature topic, a reminder, RuxCon is taking place in Sydney on the 29th of November. It's Australia's best technical security conference, and the lineup looks great. It's only $60 for 2 days, which includes sausages at the Sunday barbecue. So head to ruxcon.org.au for more information and to register. Right, now that's out of the way with, it's time to talk about hosting services, or more specifically, evil hosting services, or bulletproof hosting services. As we discussed in the news segment with Mania, it turns out a company named Mikolo, which was based in California, had been hosting all sorts of badness. In typical bulletproof hosting tradition, the company was hosting servers that were used to control massive botnets, much in the same way the Russian Business Network hosted similar sort of stuff until it too was shut down. Now, Mikolo found itself in trouble with its upstream providers following the publication of a series of articles by the Washington Post's Brian Krebs. Nice work, Brian. But where this story gets really interesting is when we talk about what happened when Mikolo's upstream providers pulled the pin on their operation. Spam levels dropped globally by an estimated 65 to 75%, and that's a no bullshit figure. Several competing security companies were bandying about the same set of figures. So is it really that easy to knock spammers offline, or will they just go deeper underground and get harder to catch, or will they just pop up in the same sort of environment in a couple of weeks? I got on the line with Kimberly Zenz, who's based in Washington, D.C., and asked her to tell us all about the closure of Mikolo and what it means for the future.
Mikolo is a company based in San Jose, California. They're also registered in New Jersey. They provided essentially bulletproof hosting services. In terms of the people behind it, it's an American registered company, but some of the leadership does have Russian names.
Now,
where could be like of Russian descent.
Now, where did they actually get their connectivity from?
They got it primarily, 93% of actually came from two companies. One is based in Arizona called Global Crossing, and one is based in California called Hurricane Electric. And they're the ones that ultimately ended up cutting Mikolo off.
Now, how were they able to operate for so long without this happening? Because I understand they have been around for a while.
iDefense first identified them as a location with a lot of malicious activity in 2006. And so, I mean, they definitely have. And that's actually a really good question. Just because both organizations, both Global Crossing and Hurricane Electric, said that they cut off Mikolo as soon as they learned about how bad they were. But it's been going on for a very long time. So the question is, how did they not know before? Did they really not know?
Yeah, it just seems a little bit sus, you know? And I've got to ask too, like, since they've gone offline, there's been a, you know, we've registered this amazing decrease in spam of around, you know, 60, 65 to
75%. It depends on who you ask because, you know, different organizations monitor different kind of chunks, but it's, the estimates are out there between 66 and 75%.
Yeah. Now, I've got to ask too, were they actually using those servers to send the spam? I thought most spam came from botnets.
They do, but botnets, you know, they have to be controlled from somewhere. And in the case of the botnets that, you know, the bot herders that were using Mikolo, they were actually using the servers to host their command and control.
So this is like your standard sort of IRC command and control channels were being hosted in
this? It depends on how they do it, but basically, you know, that's how they would connect to it, yeah.
Okay.
There's
different
ways of doing it.
That's interesting because I understand now there's a lot of research on, the bad guys are starting to branch out and use Web 2.0 services like blogs and whatnot to do the command and control, which will change the game a little bit, I'd imagine.
Well, that's actually part of the concern about things like clothing organizations like Mikolo is that will they move to another organization similar, or will that sort of push the cyber criminals into the next level of sophistication? At which point it becomes that much harder to monitor and track and investigate them.
So do you think that's likely what's going to happen, that there'll be this new sort of spurt of innovation in the underworld?
Mikolo all by itself, no. But this is the third company this has happened to recently with pretty high profile. If they keep going on this trend, then it is going to push people into adopting already available services. They're just more complex and more difficult to use and more expensive. But, you know, for them, the issue is maximum return for minimum risk and cost. And the risk is a big part of that. So if they feel like they can't get reliable service, they will move to the next level quicker than otherwise.
Did it strike you as odd that they were able to open, that they were able to operate in the United States? Because, of course, we saw the Russian business network and, you know, it was a very big deal at the time that these guys had all sorts of links into government and there was a lot of rumor and innuendo about these guys bribing government officials to stay active. And yet here we've seen a very similar operation being hosted in California.
Well, they're not the first one, actually. In September, another company, Atrivo, also called Intercage, which is another California-based, California-based company, they were closed under a similar situation, sort of outed for being a service provider to many criminals. I mean, this does happen. Why it's allowed to persist so long, I'm not really sure. I mean, the companies themselves are, you know, obviously know what their customers are doing, but law enforcement doesn't seem very able to move against them for whatever reason.
Now, one thing that struck me about this is some of the commentators have said, well, they'll just open up in another jurisdiction. But it did occur to me that countries with the type of legal system that would allow organizations like this to profit and to flourish are also the sort of countries where connectivity wasn't particularly good. So for that reason, do you think it made sense that they were putting stuff in California?
Well, actually, I mean, that is a possibility because there's a lot of countries that still provide enough connectivity. I mean, the case of RBN shows definitely Russia could do it. China is popular among some Russian cyber criminals. It's a different jurisdiction. There's language barriers to investigations. You know, they definitely are able to provide that kind of services. And it also doesn't have to be across the whole country. I mean, back on the China case, you could do it out of Hong Kong or Shenzhen. You wouldn't have to do it out of, you know, Kashgar. There's a couple of big issues with this. It's not like, you know, whether or not Asprox is down right now. It's, you know, it'll take them about a week to get up. But so what's the real net gain if you aren't really interfering with them that much and at the same time you are interfering with your own ability to monitor and investigate? And there's a debate about that because the other end is you can't just let people operate with impunity. So what are you going to do? And then the other issue is what are the criteria? I mean, RBN was pretty bad. Mikolo, pretty bad. Intercage, pretty bad. Estimane's pretty bad. But these have all been basically closed through public outing and through public pressure. And long term, that really shouldn't be the mechanism. There should be a mechanism for dealing with organizations for that, and it shouldn't be like fear of the Washington Post.
Yeah, well, I was going to actually ask you that, whether or not you think that we'll see more of these sort of shutdowns now that they've proven so effective. I would have thought like a 65% drop in spam levels would be enough to maybe get government regulators to think, hey, you know, if we move on this stuff more effectively, we're going to seriously disrupt the business of these bad guys.
Well, that would be nice. I would be really happy to see that. Although, you know, the question is really how much effect can really be happened. I mean, for the case of like Wearzal, which is one of the spam botnets, it was on Intercage and then they had problems there. When Intercage was closed, so it moved to Mikolo and now they're having problems and they'll move somewhere else. You'd have to really, I guess, whack a lot of moles to keep them from being able to pop up again.
So it really is that old game of whack-a-mole popping up again.
I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but that's how it looks to me.
I mean, have you noticed any other sort of trends in the sort of badness business lately that's relevant to this particular case?
Well, long-term, I mean, particularly in the Russian market, you see growing sophistication. I mean, there's still a lot of like low-level criminals, that's definitely still the bulk, but at the upper levels, you're definitely seeing like either more sophisticated operations in one operation or two different groups kind of teaming up for maximum returns just to make things as simple and as profitable as possible. And that's a trend that's happening on its own. But if you start worrying about your bulletproof hosting providers, that's really just going to push people into that more.
Well, it's interesting too, because we saw some recent research from Microsoft, which suggests that phishing isn't actually that profitable, save for a few of the more organized groups who actually engage in it, because they actually need to be quite sophisticated to counter fraud detection mechanisms. So it seems the days of the freelance, you know, two or three man groups doing these sorts of things, I mean, they seem numbered, don't they?
If it's something that along that level, like the spam operations or basic level phishing, then yes.
There was a bit of related research which suggested that spam generally gets a response rate in the order of 1 in 12.5 million messages sent.
Yeah, I think you're actually referring to the Spamalytics report that was put out by two California universities. And, I mean, if they're right, then, I mean, it's a really small return on almost everything. And their total full response rate, getting people buying the pharmaceutical spam, not just clicking on the links, but actually trying to make a purchase out of over 470 million email sent. Only 28 tried to make a purchase.
Yeah, the other thing that I find interesting about this, and this might be maybe a more effective strategy for combating spam, is to actually block the sites where the transactions are made. Because look, you know, as you said, the sophistication is probably going to go through the roof now that these guys have been forced off their cushy bulletproof hosting service, and they can use all sorts of mechanisms for command and control. But at the end of the day, someone still needs to go to an actual website and make the purchase for this stuff. Do you think that could be a viable approach to combating this sort of activity?
You have to try something, but long-term on that one, that's also very difficult. I mean, they could follow the trend currently observed in some of the phishing, which is, again, fast, low hosting on botnets to make it hard to find. And then also, even the ones that you wouldn't think would be that hard, it can be really difficult to get a site taken down. I mean, I know that from personal experience because I work for VeriSign, and I have friends in Russia, like investigators, and they want .com sites cut off because they cannot get anyone in any of the registrars or hosting companies to do anything. And VeriSign is not allowed to by law. We can't do that. We'll lose our contract with ICANN. Like, we really can't. And there's no way for many of the identified sites to be taken down.
What do you think needs to happen for some serious action to be taken against these sorts of groups?
Well, I'd like to see some, like, a shift in priority, just because I think for a lot of law enforcement groups within the cybercrime investigations, they really care and they're very committed, but overall it's not up there the way I think it could be.
They're too busy dealing with more traditional crime types, I guess?
Well, I mean, if you look at the case of Mercola, look how much was going on Mercola for so long and nothing was done about it. It took, you know, public embarrassment to interfere. And I don't think that's because all of, like law enforcement was lazy and didn't care. Actually, you know, I'm sure they weren't, and they were running investigations, but they have so many people and it's over so many jurisdictions and so many countries that it's very difficult to handle.
So I guess what you're saying, Kimberly, is that this temporary respite from spam is just that. It's temporary.
I hope I'm wrong, but I'm afraid yes.
Okay, well, look, thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business again.
All right, well, thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Kimberly Zenz on the line from Washington there. Up next, it's time for our sponsor interview. Each week, we get our sponsors on the show to have a chat about what they're seeing out there in security land. This week's sponsor is Checkpoint Software Technologies. And we're joined by Checkpoint Australia's Engineering Services Manager, Steve McDonald, to have a chat about capacity planning. As you'll hear Steve explain, there are many, many enterprises out there with next to no understanding of the capacity of their networks. So when the proverbial hits the fan, they're all left scratching their heads, wondering what the hell has gone wrong. It's time to get back to basics, Steve says, and start monitoring things like CPU, memory, and storage. The basics.
We've been facing a lot of problems this year and last year with customers who haven't taken care of capacity planning in a security context. And whilst it's nothing to do with security specifically, it does impact when things don't work because people always blame the security infrastructure to start. We're seeing a lot of business disruption in that space.
I love how everyone from developers to, you know, infrastructure managers love to blame IPSs on reliability and capacity issues. Does that still happen?
Yeah, look, I'd reckon 100% of IPSs have been moved from inline to bridge at some point in their life, but it certainly happens, particularly when we start talking about converged devices like firewalls with embedded IPS. That just takes that problem to a whole new level. And as we move forward, the embedded IPS in a firewall or another device, that's going to be the norm, and this problem's just going to get worse rather than better.
So specifically, what sort of mistakes are you seeing, Dave?
It's really simple. Like many of our customers, and we continuously have this discussion with so many of our customers, aren't even monitoring or keeping records of the basics like CPU utilization in boxes, let alone more important things like throughput, connection rates, and that type of information. This is not hard to get, and it's not hard to keep, and it really is quite critical because if you don't understand your seasonal business, if you're in retail, obviously there are some peaks and troughs, and in the gaming industry, they've got probably a better grasp of it than most. And even in the banking and finance, we continually get surprised around Christmas with our capacity issues and security networks.
So what they're just, you're saying that you've been in installations or, you know, facilities where you've gone up to see what's happening on a particular box or a router or whatever, and you've seen the CPU sitting there at 80% solid, and, you know, those machines are working pretty hard, and that's perhaps an issue that's not being addressed the way it should.
Yeah, look, that kind of thing should never come as a surprise to anybody in this current market. I mean, every single product out there has got built-in features to take care of this stuff. And it's normally a case of people just not turning on what they've purchased. I mean, it's simple, rudimentary stuff that should be well taken care of.
Yeah, so what do you think is going to tip the scales in this instance? You reckon we're going to see a few absolute disasters with stuff falling over, or...?
Well, we've already seen that, to tell you the truth. You know, these kind of capacity issues occur quite...
So when I was speaking to you yesterday and you had to move our interview because you were out at a customer engagement, this is what you were talking about?
Yeah, something very similar where it was... these things normally arise as a result of your product's not working, come in and fix it for us, and then we find that the product's working better than we anticipated, and it's just a basic issue then.
So what, you come in and they say, oh, it's not working, it's made all of these systems fall down, and then you look at it and you go, my God, it actually is working, and that's a bloody miracle.
Well, sometimes. I mean, I'm not suggesting things work all the time, but, you know, that's the reality. Is in a lot of cases, it comes as a surprise to people to understand that their boxes are really working at 140 to 150% of their design capacity.
Yeah, yeah, yikes. I guess they'd wonder why they keep spending more on air conditioning each month, eh?
Yeah, the thing I'm looking at is I think that with the economic downturn and everybody turning their focus a little bit more inwardly at what they have rather than new stuff, we've got a unique opportunity now to get on top of this, because people are potentially going to have some time and some energy to direct in making things that they have better rather than buying new things and playing with new technology.
But how can you squeeze more capacity out of old stuff?
Well, it's not such a case of squeezing more capacity. It's just understanding where your breaking point is, understanding what you have. I mean, we estimate that maybe as few as 1 in 10 organizations actually understand their current capabilities with regard to capacity, and probably even less actually when you look at the security infrastructure specifically. And then we think that the rates for future planning are probably 1 in 100 of our customers actually have some idea or some meaningful idea of maybe next year and beyond as to where they're going and what they need.
Well, look, I suppose if all of the new rollouts seem to be on hold, which is something that I'm hearing from a few different vendors, and Intel, of course, just released their latest results, and they were a bloody, you know, there's red ink all over them, profits going backwards, all sorts of bad stuff. So it does look like projects are on hold, but I suppose if people can get out there and make themselves useful in this way, I suppose this is downturn IT management, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the other thing is that hot topics at the moment are virtualization, consolidation, cloud computing, software as a service. But, I mean, that obviously will save some level of cost. But if you don't understand what's going on in your network at the moment and if you don't have a true picture of your security requirements there, just consolidating this and handballing the problem to somebody else might not be the best way forward.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people realize just how many held open connections you have when you're dealing with like certain Ajax applications as well. And I've wondered about this too, is if you get a really massive enterprise that all of a sudden throws some rudimentary applications out into the cloud, geez, man, that's a lot more open connections that you all of a sudden have to deal with. Have you seen that cause problems for anywhere?
Well, I haven't seen it at that level, but stepping back a bit and looking at it from a slightly larger angle, it's more about where these cloud applications are going to be hosted and what kind of carriage you need between there. You know, it makes a lot of sense to start moving cloud computing offshore. That has its own latency and security ramifications, and also then the risk profile associated with moving it out is who carries the risk. And, you know, if you're moving your operations to an offshore and outsourcing with customer records, then set of discussions we've had with some customers is around trying to understand who's liable if something goes wrong. And
well,
them or you.
The buck always stops with you, unfortunately. You can't outsource risk.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right, Steve McDonald, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Patrick.
What can I keep the man them playing star? You think you can play piano, sir? Get out the place, man!
Well, that's it for this week's edition of Risky Business. Thanks again to Checkpoint Software Technologies for paying the bills. And a big thanks to all of our guests for giving up their time to speak to us this week. You can sign up for weekly podcast email reminders at itradio.com.au/security. And this week's Sound Foundation track is Dog War by King Tide, and you can buy it as a DRM-free MP3 at soundfoundation.com.au. I've actually played this one a few times in the show. I quite like it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
You're playing good. I like the horn section too. Man, the keyboard playing good.